kind of want to avoid taking Rogue, but I don't think I can.
Rogue One? Or Ranger One?
Yeah, that was the other thing I told Angela. I was like, look, I would rather try the new Ranger, but like, if that opens the floodgates of Unearthed Arcana, I'm happy to skip Ranger.
Yeah.
Live from the Mundangerous High Roller Room in New York City, I'm your host Shane.
And I'm your host Ishan.
And welcome to episode 61 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
In this episode, we're talking about how to use the artifact that's the bane of well-planned games everywhere, the Deck of Many Things. But first, the party draws its own hand in the Morning Glory campaign. And later, the gambler knows when to hold 'em, and more importantly, knows when to fold 'em in the Character Creation Forge.
So before we do that, we want to talk about the revised Ranger. And I got a chance to actually play the revised Ranger last week, which was really exciting. One of our listeners, Mark Blaine, invited me to play in a Princess Bride one-shot, which gave me the chance to try it out at level 12. I played a Deepstalker.
Which is basically the Drizzt Do'Urden version of the new Ranger.
It is very Drizzt-y, yeah. Drizzt-ish.
Drizzt?
Yeah.
So tell us about this one shot.
Okay, so it was kind of cool. We started out in prison and then made our way through a maze, ran into Billy Crystal's character, who had been captured by Humperdinck. His wife was being held hostage, and Humperdinck was doing these like magical experiments. Well, turns out, after we tracked Billy Crystal's wife into the Swamp of Sorrows.
Miracle Max's wife.
Sorry, Miracle Max's
into
wife.
The Fire Swamp.
The Swamp of Fire, that one. Yeah, whatever it is. You could tell I did not watch Princess Bride right before it. I did avoid, we avoided quicksand and all the fire.
The ROUSs?
Well, we ran into the ROUSs.
Okay. Or did they run into you?
Oh, they ran into us in the lair of a black dragon.
There are black dragons in the Fire Swamp. Wesley was totally wrong. You cannot build a house there and live peacefully.
So here's the thing, all right, is Humperdinck was killed
Humperdinck
by the black dragon.
Oh, well, okay, black dragons are good.
Who shape changed and then continued to act as him.
Oh, I dig it.
Yeah, so it was totally like that sort of thing, right? So then we had to kill the black dragon to rescue Miracle Max's wife.
Right. Even if she was dead, though, like, he could bring her back.
Well, I mean, depends how long she's been dead, right? But it was cool because we ran it over Roll20, and Mark did some really cool things that you can't do at a normal table that worked really well in Roll20. Basically because Roll20 has dynamic lighting, so when you move your mini around the map, it changes your... Like the fog of war moves with you, right? So,
like Baldur's Gate.
Exactly. So, the maze, for example, we literally got lost on the map and had to keep moving our tokens around to spot.
Were you guys
not
at home using graph paper to figure out where you were?
Well, we didn't realize we were in a maze until about halfway through. And then there were teleporters. It was pretty amusing. And I thought it was cool because it was kind of a neat challenge. It, just as we got frustrated, we ran into a gelatinous cube who caught us by surprise. And as we ran from that, we discovered the trick of the teleportation within the maze. And that's how we got out. And then what was really neat was when we fought the black dragon, we did it in the dark.
Oh.
Which I think was frustrating for some of the players who didn't have dark vision. But as a deep stalker, I had great dark vision.
Right, it was basically built for you.
Well, yeah, but dragons have blind sense, so it wasn't really that advantageous. But anyway, so... What was cool was, as you know, the players had a general idea, like where my character is here on the map and I can see like just the area that I'm in, right? And as they moved around the map, they were like, okay, I will move in this direction, I will move in this direction. And then it was like, oh crap, as they finally got to the dragon mini on the map.
And it was like bumping into it.
Yeah, like literally by bumping into it, it was like, I attack it. Which you can't do at a normal table, right? There's no way to really hide that from players. So that was really fun to like be a part of.
So from a mechanics perspective, what were your favorite enemy and greater favorite enemy?
Humanoids, because humanoids
obviously
are broken.
Right.
And my greater favorite enemy was giants. Look, if I ran into Andre the Giant, all right, I wasn't taking any chances.
You're supposed to recruit him to your side.
Honestly, I just counted and rolled randomly because I was like, I don't want to try and metagame this or whatever.
And why would you pick dragons? Like,
Because there's no Bride. Dragons, Princess Bride. Right? Yeah.
There's screeching eels. Those are kind of similar.
So anyway, it was a blast. We had fun, and it was a good chance to test the Ranger because we had some sneaky bits. We had some, you know, group combat bits, and then we had one big enemy to kind of take down. Mm-hmm.
Interesting note, Humperdinck himself, I think, would have been statted as a Ranger. If you recall, he can track a Falcon on a cloudy day, which, well, that's tough.
Yeah, I'll buy that. He also could have been an Eagle Barbarian. Eagle totem?
Right, probably.
He just saw it really far away.
Actually, honestly, Rogue One, right. Expertise in perception.
Yeah. Which naturally is what I did. I took one level of Rogue of and then course. 11 levels of Deep Stalker.
All right, so let's talk about the Ranger itself. You cover it pretty in depth in a blog post, which I don't know, I got like halfway through it.
Yeah, it was a lot of words. But yeah, that's up on mundangerous.com if you're interested in reading the whole breakdown ability by ability. The key takeaways for the revised Ranger is they've clearly heard the feedback that it's underpowered in combat. And so they've taken steps to try and power that up. So for example, they've super front loaded it. You now get advantage on initiative at level 1, and you get advantage on attacks against creatures that haven't acted yet in the first round of combat. So you're going to lead off your first attack. You're likely to be the first one to go, and you're also going to get advantage on the attack roll,
which makes it super dippable.
That's my concern. I mean, that's my main takeaway, is that like it looks pretty good as a single class, but it looks super broken if you're just taking one or two or three levels.
Yeah, there are a lot of things in here that happen in the first three levels that are great for a lot of different characters.
Yeah,
I mean, I could see a paladin being like, I always have terrible dexterity, but one level of Ranger gets me advantage on all those initiative checks, and now I don't have to go last always.
And you get your favorite enemy, so it's super easy to track things.
Great for a vengeance paladin.
Yeah, also that's a weird thing with favorite enemy, is it's now there's you lose one choice, but you get a damage boost against your favorite enemy. And humanoids, which you used to pick two subtypes, are now just one blanket choice. So everyone will be taking humanoid. Like, Ranger's really good at killing people and orcs and goblins and that type.
Yeah, pretty much everything you face at low levels.
Yeah, yeah. You're just getting a +2 damage boost, which is fine. I mean, that's not going to upset
lots
the game.
Of, lots of times it's something that... that you're attacking at high levels too.
Yeah.
Right? The mage.
Right.
The BBEG warlord.
Right. But at level 6, that jumps to a +4. You pick another favorite enemy from the sort of the higher level enemy groups, so like giants and dragons and that sort of thing. You keep basically all of your wilderness exploration tier abilities, and you get a bunch of combat abilities, which is good. I think the hunter now is really competitive at a straight 20. They didn't fix some of the complaints about the class. The capstone at level 20 is sort of weak. At level 8, you get half of the cunning action, and then at level 14, you keep vanish, which was the other half.
Yeah.
They changed hide in plain sight, so it's now a little more useful in combat.
You mean useful at all, anytime?
Yeah. The knock on it, though, is that like it's not really hiding in plain sight the way it used to be. It's more just like hiding better when you can hide.
Yeah.
And then primeval awareness got... That was sort of the Ranger's danger radar that used to work within like a mile to 6 mile radius, depending on what you were finding. And it kind of told you what was in the area around you. Now it's super targeted to your favorite enemies, but it's like a radar. So it tells you right, exactly yeah. where they are.
My favorite thing is you pick humanoids
and do it.
You're
in
a city. Yeah.
Yeah. It's weird.
Agreed.
It's kind of what it is. You know, it's like, I like it. And this is what I talked about in the blog post, was like, it really helps with that ambush, counter ambush kind of flavor of the Ranger, because now you see everything coming, right? You spend a minute, you know everything that's in the area around you, and you can plan accordingly.
And the issues that I have with it, I think, really are just boil down to issues with having humanoids as one of your favorite enemies.
Yeah. People. Yeah. It used to apply much more broadly, which I could see the appeal of, even though it gave you less information. So that one, I think, is kind of a wash in terms of power. It's just swapping it, and people who liked it before and found it useful are going to be disappointed. Deep Stalker is now an archetype, or sorry, Conclave.
Oh, right.
Cool name. Better flavor. I'm fine with that.
So yeah, basically, Deep Stalker is Driss Doerden. Hunter, remains the same as the Ranger subclass that had the same name. And that's basically Aragorn.
Yep.
And Beastmaster is Tarzan or the actual Beastmaster.
The Beastmaster. Yeah.
Jar.
Yeah. So Deepstalker is cool. It plays around in the darkness a lot. So you get an extra attack on the first round of combat, which is neat. But then you get to use your hide ability even when other creatures have dark vision. Right. So like if you're in the dark and trying to hide from a creature with dark vision, you normally couldn't. But this says if you meet the other conditions, dark vision doesn't harm you.
Right. Great, except when the dragon has blind sense.
Yeah, well, you know. But it also gives you either dark vision to 90 feet or plus 30 to your existing dark vision. Mm-hmm. Meaning if you're of any race that can see in the dark, you can now see better than everyone else in your race. Mm-hmm. Which again, ambushing, counter ambushing, that sort of thing. You avoid threats extremely well and you see them very far. So I love that flavor. I think that's really, really cool. It also gets to re-roll an attack that you've missed. And I noted some wonkiness with the wording. You can trade in offhand attacks for mainhand attacks.
Yeah, it's not really re-roll, right? It's if you miss, you can make another attack.
You can make another attack, yeah.
It doesn't specify with what weapon.
Right. Which is cool if it's like a thrown attack, right? I get it. All right, well, I don't necessarily have another hand axe to throw, so now I can make another attack.
Right.
But it's super weird when that's like the butt end of your polearm for D4 damage, and now you're using the blade of your glaive.
Now, it is called flurry, right? So I can see that the intent is that you're attacking with the butt
so
end, you miss,
things.
And so you just, you know, fling the other end of your polearm into the attack and just make it quickly while they're dodging.
Right.
I get that. Mechanically speaking, though, you get to where you're like, well, I guess maybe I'll close my eyes with the butt end of my polearm, hope I miss, and then I can make an extra attack with my actual real weapon that has, like, fire on it.
Yeah. I could see the flavor of it either way. I just don't like the sloppiness of the mechanic.
Yeah.
So I don't know. We'll see where it goes. I don't think it's going to break anything. I just think it's weird. Beastmaster.
This one needed the most work, and it got the most work.
Definitely got work. One of the big complaints about the Beastmaster was that your animal companion died too much.
It's not going to happen anymore.
No.
Can I just play an animal companion?
I was joking about that on Twitter, right? Like, be a ranger, get an ape companion, give all of his ability score increases to intelligence, so he becomes like a normal, above human average sentient ape. Kill off that pesky ranger who keeps following you around. Start taking levels of ranger. Initiate Planet of the Apes. So, yeah, you get normal hit dice as you scale your HP. So that will scale in line as a normal creature. You also get proficiency bonus to a bunch of stuff. So your AC will scale. You get proficiency in all saves. You gain proficiency.
You being the animal companion.
The animal companion, right, which is me the ape.
And it's basically everything that the ranger does. Because Beastmaster doesn't get extra attack like the other rangers.
Right. It gets its extra attack through the animal companion.
Right.
So it's cool, like, it's super tied now, where you used to have, like, shared spells and those sorts of things that gave you some increased utility through different animal companion choices. Now, your animal companion is basically just for combat. And you have a finite list of choices. There's no flying. I guess there is a burrowing one, but, like, you know, there's an ape and a mule. So it's not quite hitting all the flavor of the ranger right now.
Yeah.
That said, I think from level 1 to 20, if you're playing a straight ranger, all of these are pretty cool implementations. Now, the Beastmaster still has some problems. It can't overcome damage resistance.
Ever.
Yeah, the beast can't, the animal companion.
Which is all of your attacks, mostly.
That's the majority of your combat effectiveness is tied to that, yeah. So if you thought you were going to roll into combat against the Tarrasque with your faithful, you know, wolf or whatever, black bear, now an option, you're going to be disappointed. You're going to leave Fluffy on the sidelines because you can't hurt the Tarrasque at all.
Also, you're probably going to stand on the sidelines because you get one attack.
Yeah. There's also some concern about the archer becoming super powerful with this ranger because of the advantage on the first round of combat. You'll get sharpshooter super often. I'm a little skeptical on how much that matters because archer is so unsatisfying to play.
Well, and of course, you're only shooting once.
The big concern is going to be for multiclassing. It's way too front-loaded, and a quick dip in it is just crazy powerful for too many other classes.
Yeah, the beast scales on character level, not class level.
Not ranger level. Yeah. Right. So you could be a level 17 fighter with a fully kitted beast.
Fully kitted?
I mean, you won't have advantage on saving throws, but it'll still be fully scaled.
Yeah.
And it'll have fighter ability score increase.
Right.
Which is another great thing
to look at.
Yeah.
I don't like how the Beastmaster sort of puts all of the ranger goodies into the beast basket, because then, you know, if your beast does die, which at mid levels is much more likely to happen than at later levels, if you can't bring it back because it takes 8 hours and, you know, you've got to go through this ritual and you could always get a sticker DM, you just can't really do anything until the beast is back, right? You're just like a guy who can hit once.
And... yeah, with advantage. You can also cast some lousy ranger spells because spellcasting didn't get fixed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I still think Hunter's Mark is in a weird spot. You know, it's like, is that really a spell? But whatever. It's an improvement for sure. So it's not perfect, but...
It's certainly getting there. It's a better iteration.
Yeah, if they fix the multi-classing component, I'd be happy if this were the ranger going forward.
Yeah, I think there are certainly other classes and subclasses where we say, eh, it's not amazing, but it's fine and you can play it and not feel like you're not contributing to the party.
Right. Also on the downside, there is no ability called Ambuscade.
Which is a shame.
Yeah. Best named ability of all Unearthed Arcana, in my opinion.
Agreed.
All right, so shall we move on to Morning Glory?
Right, so Morning Glory is our 3-year, 80-session 5e game set in Eberron. The party is nearing the end of the campaign. They're around level 18, and they are basically trying to figure out how to destroy a fiendish overlord, a horrible demonic abomination of deific power. So they have everything they need to create an apparatus that can enable them to kill an immortal being. They just need the true name of the one they want to kill. So they need the true name of the fiendish overlord, Belshalor, the Shadow in the Flame. The darkness that infects the entire religion of the Silver Flame, which Brand has learned is...
allegedly.
You have learned the heresy is true. You did some research at the library.
You can't prove I know that.
Brand did learn that the Silver Flame is actually just a small part of the Kaelok Shash, the energy field created by the martyrdom of the entire Kuwattle race that binds all of the fiendish overlords deep beneath the ground in Kyber. So... perhaps this is not just about Belshalor in the end.
So here's the thing, though. If I know my pal Belshalor, I feel like he's not letting anybody else out.
Huh.
Yeah. I mean, I just feel like, you know, he's in the selfish end of the spectrum, not the, you know, rampant chaos end. So.
Yeah, yeah, kind of.
Yeah. So in that regard, I'm not too worried.
So the party is in possession of the Book of Vile Darkness, which they know is supposed to contain the true names of fiends. But since it can only be opened by an evil creature, they've had to find one. Strangely enough, Brand, it turns out, is not evil.
Proven.
But one has offered to help them. And that is the Bound Book Imp of Behemoth, who has been kind of a reluctant advisor and literal left hand to the party.
Yeah, you could say that. Reluctant.
So the party decides that they will finally take Behemoth up on his offer to open the book. But of course, him being a devil, he wants to strike a bargain first. They want a name out of the book. He wants a name out of the book. And I believe the way you guys bargained it was you said, we'll give you a name from the book. And then out of character, we're like, but we can give him like a random name, right?
Yeah.
Right? Like, we can give him a name of like someone who doesn't really matter.
Right.
And Behemoth seemed pretty eager. He was like, yeah, yeah, I like that. You get a name, I get a name. Okay, let's do this.
Yeah, I saw American Pie, too. I know how that turns out.
They retreat to the wilderness because, for some reason, they didn't want to cause collateral damage, which was nice. It was nice of you guys. I thought that was growth.
Character growth.
Yeah. Behemoth opens the book and begins leafing through it, and the party can tell that there's lots of information about creating undead, undead grafts, ways to conduct torture, how to destroy souls, treatises on effective tyranny...
because, you know, only lawful characters are really going to commit things to right, writing, right?
Yeah. Writing a book. And there are, of course, instructions on fiend binding. But then everyone makes a constitution save. Those who fail take 24d10 necrotic damage. Those who succeed take half.
Cool, Ishin. Thanks.
You're welcome. Everyone passes out. And then they wake up in a featureless room made of an unidentifiable stone that they are unable to affect in any way. And the only thing in the room is a pedestal with a deck of cards sitting on top of it. When someone finally approaches the deck and attempts to pick it up, they all fly off in every direction through the walls, except for one card that sticks to the wall face down, and a door appears. Through some experimentation, the party determines that the only way to open this door is to draw the card. And we'll find out what happens later in the episode.
So, we knew that this was the deck of many things.
Yes, he did.
Because we are experienced players and knew that we were of sufficient level and that Ishan has a propensity for always including the deck of many things in his campaign.
That is correct.
So, what is the deck of many things, Ishan?
It's just the worst thing to happen to D&D.
It's, or the best.
Best? It's the best thing to happen to games when you're 14.
Right.
It's an artifact that comes from way back in the day. It's a Greyhawk artifact that has been in every version of the Dungeon Master's Guide.
So it's Gary Gygax's personal pet.
Right. If you think Tomb of Horrors is like kind of random and just screws with players, the deck of many things is literally the only thing that it does.
Right. So it's always presented as a deck of cards, and it's usually either 13 or 22 cards, because that's a combination of the count of the face cards in your traditional playing card deck and the jokers.
More powerful versions of the deck have
more cards.
Yeah, 22 cards.
And then the idea is that players choose to draw.
The idea is that players, being idiots,
right, choose to draw cards from the deck, and then when they draw a card, it issues some effect. Sometimes it's a boon. Often it's a bane. Sometimes it's powerful enough to just ruin your campaign.
Right. So the player announces, I want to draw however many cards. It's usually between 1 and 3.
And then they are bound
right.
to do it.
They draw, a thing happens. They draw, a thing happens.
If they took 3, I mean, that's on them.
Right. For example, in second edition, there was a card called Skull. As you may be able to guess, it's a bad card. An avatar of death appears, and the player who drew the card has to defeat it in single combat. If they lose, if they die, they're just destroyed forever and can never be brought back to life.
Yeah.
You know, whatever.
Right. The thing is, this isn't tied to a level. So
right.
you could be fighting death at any level, and that's sort of what makes this a wonky introduction to your campaign, is like, how do you place the difficulty of card draws on players? Is 6th level too early? Is 12th level too early? I have no idea.
Right. At what level are you equipped to fight death?
Right. Yeah. Or, I mean, like, at what level are you equipped to draw balance, mm-hmm. which just flips your alignment?
Which, if you're a 5th edition player, that may sound like, oh, okay, that's complicated. But, you know, it could take a character that is good and now they are evil, and how do they fit in the party? And that certainly causes problems for a game that is well planned.
Right. Or from prior editions, it was like, oh, you're a paladin? Oh, give a
right.
Now you've fallen.
And you don't get any cool, awesome stuff.
No. Yeah.
You're just a fighter
now. With charisma.
These are the kinds of effects that you see in the deck of many things. Something that can completely eliminate an entire character from the game.
Just so you don't think this is the wonkiness of previous editions, right? We can pull the 5e examples too.
Yeah.
Like, the sun gives you 50,000 XP and a random wondrous item, which I know nobody has those tables memorized. 50,000 XP takes you from 19 to 20. It can reasonably give you 3 or 4 levels mm-hmm. at a mid-level.
Which now screws up the challenge rating of everything
Every
a GM has to do. Yeah, yep. it's ridiculous.
And even just giving one player like just one extra level feels really weird,
mm-hmm.
right?
Especially when, for the most part, everyone is leveling up at the same rate.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Or something like Talon. Every magic item you have disintegrates, and all your artifacts disappear. So let's hope that the MacGuffin artifact that the party needed to complete the quest wasn't being held by that character.
Right, yeah, and let's hope that MacGuffin was in fact an artifact at least.
Right. Oh, players, if you're drawing from the deck of many things, take all your artifacts and give it to someone who is not currently drawing.
Right.
Be smart about this. Or of course, look at the moon card. This is a boon, but it can still ruin your campaign. You get 1d3 wishes.
Yeah, and if you think giving players 3 wishes is not going to completely ruin it, like, even if they're well-worded wishes, like, if you give them what they want, your campaign is probably over. If you attempt to undermine what they're wishing for, you're going to have to screw your campaign over so hard anyway that, like, now the players are taken completely out of whatever story you were doing, and they're now fighting wish effects.
Yeah.
And that's, like, a straightforward way to ruin a campaign. There's way more exotic ways.
Yeah, remember, you got 22 cards.
Right.
So if it's so ridiculous, why does this thing even exist?
Okay, so serious answer, to ruin your campaign. Mm-hmm. It's a way of signing off, right? It's a way of saying, cool, we've gotten as far as we can go. Now let's just leave it in tatters.
Yeah, it's a ruin the dress after a wedding.
Right, exactly.
Remember that one woman did drown doing that, so...
Well, you know, more than one character has drowned from the deck of many things, so yes. It's fitting.
Or been eternally trapped in a void.
Or the dungeon, the donjon.
Yeah, there are multiple cards that just trap your soul for eternity, yeah. So...
Goodbye, PC.
It's also a way to tempt those high-level characters, because, you know, once you hit max level, you stop leveling.
Yeah.
What else can you do?
Right.
Like, tempt fate, you know? Because actually some of these effects are things that could be remedied by characters that are high level enough, that are powerful enough, assuming that they're not the ones getting screwed. And if you do have players who've been in D&D for, you know, decades, I will say it, at the end of a campaign, when you know it's going to be over anyway, or at very high levels, players get super excited when they see the deck.
It's kind of a badge of honor thing.
Yeah, like I made it through the deck.
Or I ruined my character, yeah, in the deck, you know?
Everyone's got that story about that character they lost.
Right, yeah. Right. Usually it was like the character that started at 15th level and yeah, lost at 16th level because, you know, that's how D&D works.
Started at 12th, made it to 15th because they drew the right card,
right,
and then lost.
Right. There are other reasons, though, reasonable reasons. Like we used it in Morning Glory, right? It was a way to test the party's strength, metal, worth, frankly.
We used a version of it.
Well, true.
We'll get to that.
And then the other thing, and I really like this idea, is use it to simulate the whimsy, fickleness, dispassion, or insanity of very powerful creatures, like deities and those sorts of things.
Right. The deck I always think of as an avatar of chaos itself, chaos incarnate. And... a smart group, when it comes up against that, will say, I think we don't want to mess with that.
Right. But, you know, if it's forced upon you.
Right.
I just love the idea of, like, this chaotic creature who, instead of making attacks in the conventional sense, just throws cards at the players randomly. They have to deal with those effects. And then, eventually, he just leaves. And leaves behind the remainder of the deck. So it's like, you've probably already dealt with some negative ones. You know the deck is kind of weighted towards positives, and he's still tempting you, and like, you're still going to sow chaos, even though he's not there. I love that idea.
Yeah, do my work for me.
Right. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's weighted in your favor now.
Think of all that awesome stuff that's in there.
Will you draw from it? Okay, so, spoiler, we used it and didn't ruin our campaign. So, how do you do that, Ishan?
Cheating.
Yeah, that helps.
Yeah. So you can use an actual deck, right? Usually when you use the deck of many things, you have playing cards or tarot cards or something like that.
Yeah. You use the face cards and the jokers, and then each face card is tied to one of the named cards of the deck.
So you just sort of look up the matching deck of many things card on the table.
Exactly.
You could just get several decks of cards, you know, and create your own quote-unquote deck of many things that is rigged so that the cards that do ruin a game or will ruin your campaign just aren't in there.
Yeah, I mean, the key to this is you only ever want to show one card at a time. You want to shuffle it after every draw, and you never show the deck to the players, right? Because you'll totally ruin the illusion if they see...
Right, if they weren't up against like a real deck, they're not going to feel like they accomplished anything.
Right, yeah. And they might flip the table. So, yeah, so when you're done with it, put it in your pocket.
Don't ever let them touch it.
Right. The other thing you can do is just mellow out the deck. Take away the crazy highs and crazy lows. There's no more wish. There's no more void.
Yeah, there are a lot of different versions of the deck of many things where people have taken the standard effects and sort of polished off the edges so that they're manageable within a campaign. So like, you know, instead of losing all of your magic items, you lose a random magic item, which right, is still really bad.
Right.
But isn't going to leave your, you know, 17th level character naked and defenseless.
In tears.
Right.
Yeah, it also avoids situations like the donjon card, which the PC just disappears and is locked away in a dungeon somewhere. Could be anywhere in the multiverse.
Mm-hmm.
how do you go forward from there? Like, unless they're next door and you can hear them screaming, what do you do?
Right. Like, it has to become now a new quest for the party. Exactly. But what if they were doing something else that was time sensitive?
Right.
Like,
right.
You got to move on.
Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe they end up in an actual dungeon somewhere that the party is aware of.
Right. Or somewhere where they can still communicate.
Right. You can also work it into the storyline, which is what we did in Morning Glory. And it's a thing, like Shane said, that I do in every one of my campaigns. I figure out some way to work in the deck as basically a dungeon. So the party is inside this room and there's a card on the wall and they realize they need to draw the card, suffer the effects, and then the door will open. So they're in a maze of doors and rooms and each one is locked with a single card from the deck that needs to be drawn by somebody. So they're standing around trying to figure out, okay, who's going to draw this card? Who's going to draw that card? Sometimes there are several doors to choose from, and sometimes there's only one, and you know that you have to draw the next one. So the way that I set it up, there was a general order to the rooms that they had to enter. Like, the maze was developed in a way where they could make choices, but those choices then branched back together. So there were like a series of cards they would have had to have drawn before they got to other ones, which sort of helped me plan out what would actually happen.
Mm-hmm.
So here's what happened. The first card was balance. As we talked about before, that used to be flipping alignment. In this case, it gave +2 to a character's lowest stat and -2 to their highest stat.
Which is infuriating.
It doesn't ruin a character, but it kind of sucks.
It sucks, yeah. Who drew that one?
Who went first? It wasn't Kallak, because only good things happened to Kallak. It wasn't you.
Uh-uh. Was it Bahar?
I think it was Bastion, actually.
Could have been Bastion.
I think it was Bastion.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he lost 2 to dexterity, and then gained 2 to intelligence.
Which was an improvement.
For the party, it worked out really well. And then inside that room, there were tapestries and paintings of people being tortured, self-flagellation, things like that. The next room was locked with the gem card, which I think you drew that, actually.
I did.
Yeah, I said, pick jewelry or gem. It doesn't really matter which one you pick. You either get 25 pieces of jewelry, each worth about 2,000 gold pieces, or 50 gems, each worth about 1,000 gold pieces, and they pop out over the course of a few minutes, like out of the card.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then inside that room, there were piles of gold everywhere, and Zorns and Rust monsters hiding in the gold. And the temptation was like, oh, look, lots of gold. You guys are savvy enough where you're like, well, don't touch the gold.
Yeah.
No. Nobody touched anything.
Inside a deck of cards. I'm not letting that happen. This was actually important for Bran, though, because that was like 50,000 gold that he then immediately, well, I mean, as soon as we got out of here, he used to fund a like anti-Lauren Davis underground movement in Thrain, basically in preparation for the attack that was coming to try and salvage some level of order in the country.
I still have an email where like the first line is, okay, I've got 50,000 gold.
Here's how I waste it. Yeah.
The next card was Jester. That's usually one of those cards where you get a bunch of XP. So yeah. Whoever drew it, I just said gain a level. You guys were level 19 actually at this point. So
right.
Difference between 19 and 20, not huge. There are multiple cards where you can gain enough XP in the deck to actually gain a level. So I set contingencies. If a character hadn't already gained a level, then they gain a level. If they had already gained a level, then they get a feat or an ability score increase. Subject to the normal ones, you know, they can't go higher than 20. It was Bahar. He gained a level. He went to level 20. And then Atasha's Hideous Laughter hit everyone, and each failed save gave one level of exhaustion. So the trick was, in each room, there was something going on relevant to the card that was drawn that was basically trying to wear the party down. Because I didn't want 22 combats.
Right, right. And, you know, the Jester, Tasha's Hideous Laughter.
There you go. The next card was the Knight, which traditionally gives you a level 4 fighter who serves you willingly.
Right, and this was drawn by Emery.
Yes.
The bard.
So she ended up with a servant who actually, it turns out, was Caius Irwinarn III.
Non-vampire.
Right. The
nephew.
King, the king of Karnath, who was actually replaced by his vampire grandfather.
Right.
Right. So solves that little problem with a power vacuum in Karnath.
Right.
And he was actually kitted out with some nice gear, so he was actually able to help and not die. Because I made him level 4.
Yeah, I don't remember him playing a big role after that.
He was not very bright. He was mostly like, he was the traditional foppish royalty. Who he had been like sent away to an estate. Like he was on a farm upstate.
So then we had the comet, which was drawn by Kallik. So that was he had to fight a monster, and then he gained a level.
Right. There was no monster present. So from then on, every time a card was drawn and a door opened, he was basically going, wait. Hold on. Is there a monster in here? Let me kill it alone.
Right.
And then there was a weird glowing meteorite that was giving off, well, levels of exhaustion as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Charming.
The next card was Skull. Usually this is the card that summons an avatar of death. However, this card, again, made the entire party...
pass out.
Yeah. Deus Ex Machina!
Yeah, so it was a flashback, and we were elves.
You were Arenal elves, all with your death masks painted on your face.
Right.
And when you come to, you are... You have your same abilities, but you know that... You are Arenal elves. You've always been Arenal elves, and you are riding on the backs of dragons high above the ocean, flying from Arenal to the northern reaches of what some part of your brain knows will someday be the Lazar Principalities.
And what were we going to do?
You're on a sacred mission to destroy the House of Vol, who have created an abomination that is a hybrid of dragon and elf. So the elves and dragons had been at war for millennia, like 40,000 years, according to Eberron lore. But about 3,000 years ago, and the party knows this now because they are these people.
Right.
So they know like when in history this is occurring. They joined forces one time.
Oh, right. Because they had to put this abomination out.
Right. Like mixing our blood, that's gross.
Yeah. Like the only thing worse than dragons... is elfish dragons. The only thing worse than elves is dragony elves.
That's right. So it's very strange, but riding on the backs of dragons, approach an island in the cold north, and they leap off the backs of these dragons and fall several thousand feet to the ground. Their feather fall spells kick in, and instead of floating gently, they hit the ground, which then shatters because all of their inertia is directed into the ground instead of their bodies.
Yeah, it's a cool scene.
And then quickly, like as other, they're part of one party and they have a specific mission. Other elves are falling from the skies and landing and dispersing and basically killing all of these other elves whom the party notices have a very strange dragon mark.
Yeah, so this is the mark of death.
Right, that Lou had noticed in the prophetic observatory.
And I believe our mission was to kill Arandas Vol, right?
That's exactly what it was, to infiltrate deep within the House of Vol's complex, find her, stop the ritual where they were trying to awaken the full power of her dragon mark. And so the party infiltrates inside, is able to quickly dispatch trolls and other like half dragon abominations that are in their way. And they finally make it to the ritual room where it turns out the mark of death gives some ability to control undead. And so there is a giant night crawler, which is an old school creature from older editions that is created basically of shadow stuff. It's a very large
worm.
Yeah, a worm made of shadow stuff. It's kind of like the gross aberrant version of a high level nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are dragons, just dragons. It's a giant scrum of dragons and half dragons and elves with death masks. And the party is battling the Nightcrawler and a green dragon who apparently is the sire of Arandas Vol. Her dad. You killed her dad.
Yeah. I think we killed her too.
Actually, what happened is you killed her dad, the green dragon, and he took out the Nightcrawler, and as you approach the ritual, right, some sort of, her mother is doing some sort of painful ritual to her back where like her massive dragon mark is sort of pulsing and glowing with light. She explodes into necrotic, just a wave of necrotic energy.
Yeah, like I said.
And you guys all pass out. You all pass out again.
Yeah, we killed her.
And then wake up as liches.
Yeah, so we killed her.
Yeah, and end up becoming her undead servants.
Right.
But you get little flashbacks throughout the next 3,000 years of her building an empire of a religious empire of the Blood of Vol and infiltrating her way into Karnath.
And then into Thrain.
and also Zendrick, yes. little by little.
So, now we've got some historical context for the next 4 days of our mission. Rogue means a rogue comes to kill you. You're betrayed by somebody.
Yes. I decided that whoever drew that, Caius, the knight, would actually look for an opportunity to stab that person in the back, if it ever showed up. I don't think it ever actually showed up. The other option, if Caius was dead, was that Kallax's aura, his paladin aura, would actually like flip, and it would give them a penalty to saving throws instead of a bonus.
Yeah, interesting.
And there were some slicing blades in there, a la the Penitent Manshot Pass from Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
Very nice.
Yeah. Sun was the next card. If they hadn't already gained a level, they got to gain a level. Kallax gained a level. Sun is probably the most powerful card in the deck, on the good end anyway. He also got a feat or an ability score improvement, so I believe he picked a feat. You picked the next card, the Fates, which allows you to undo one awful thing. That's just sort of the normal standard fate card that works out really well. So you just sort of kept that in your back pocket.
I don't think I ever used that.
Oh, no, you did.
I can't wait to find out how. Did I use it in this room? Yeah. That's right. Uh-huh. Now I remember.
Yeah, okay. Now you remember.
Yeah.
And that opened you into an observatory. The next card was Moon, which Lou drew. It gave only one wish. It needed to be used within the next real 10 minutes. So I set a timer, laid it on the table and said, you have 10 minutes to come up with a wish, write it down. Also, there was a werewolf in the room, which that might have been what Kallax dispatched very quickly. Susie, who plays Lou, the crazy aberrant warlock, used her wish to make sure that from now on, when Lou tried to convince anyone to join her cult, that they would actually listen.
Yeah, right.
And I gave her permanent glibness when talking about this, so she couldn't roll less than a 15 on her persuasion.
The worst part of that was that she then immediately tried to recruit the party.
Yeah.
And we all had to consider it.
You didn't have to join.
Right.
You just had to hear her out. That's really, I think, the best way that could have worked out. If you had gotten the wish, I know it would have been rules lawyered for 10 full minutes.
I don't think that's true.
No?
When I actually cast wish in the game, I didn't rules lawyer it. I threw myself upon your mercy.
Yeah, but you didn't do that until the game was basically about over and you knew that you would never have an opportunity to cast wish again.
I mean, I would have done something for the good of Thrain because I thought about it when she was doing it. And what I ended up spending my gold on, I would have spent my wish on.
Well, that's nice of you.
Because I know how to metagame wish, which is you do things that are good for story purposes and not for mechanical purposes.
And do something selfless, right?
Right.
I guess I could let that slide.
Right, yeah.
If Kallax only drew good cards, Emery, for the most part, only drew bad cards.
So bad.
She's the worst luck. She drew Uriel, the Medusa card that gives a -3 to saving throws, I believe. I just made this a -2 because that's more usable. And there's a basilisk in there, which you could tell because there was a stone sculpture garden.
Oh, we found the garden before we found the basilisk, though. Right. That was
You're
nice.
You're like, I think there's a basilisk here.
Right.
The next card, you drew Talons. Before we began the session, I made everybody write down their attuned items and write down who was carrying cube. So you drew this one. You were not carrying cube.
Are you sure?
No, actually, no. I think
was.
You were.
Yeah,
you were carrying cube.
I carried cube by default as
right.
a champion's belt, a championship belt around my
right.
waist.
WWE belt.
Yes.
So Talons, you lose all magic items, and cube, being an artifact, disappears. And I think you said, that.
Yeah. Use the fates.
That's right. Yeah, you actually said, that doesn't happen. I was like, no, it does. That's what the card does. You know, it doesn't happen.
Right.
And I think you threw the fates card
at me. Oh, I definitely
threw
the fates card at you. Yeah.
And inside there was a rookery. The next card was Donjon. Dungeon?
No, it's pronounced Donjon.
You think so?
It is, yeah. Because a donjon is not a dungeon. It's like the inner keep. I believe it's pronounced Don Juan.
Oh, of course. Who got that one?
It was Bastion, wasn't it?
I think it was Bastion.
Yeah.
It was Bastion. Yeah. Cameron got screwed over a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. They were imprisoned without any items. However, as opposed to the normal Donjon card, I had it so that they could still speak through the card. So they could still interact with everybody else. They could stay in the game without just sort of being bored and not existing anymore.
Right. But he was actually imprisoned inside this contraption
elsewhere. Yeah.
Yeah, so we didn't know that at the time, but
right.
we came to find out
yes eventually. Oh right, by the way, he's still here.
Right.
The next card was Key. That gave an improved magic item. I actually determined an improvement to one magic item that each person was carrying, because everyone basically had their endgame gear. So I just sort of picked like their favorite thing and made it a little bit better. And, you know, whoever got this, I think Emery actually got this one.
That sounds about right.
Yeah. It upgraded her bow to a +3, which was nice. Next card was the Void, which usually just makes you disappear and you're gone forever. Or I think you're imprisoned, actually, is what usually happens.
Yeah.
And that becomes a quest in and of itself.
Right.
In this case, their mind was sucked out of their body and they were incapacitated and could only follow simple commands. But I allowed them to play another character. So Caius was there, so they got to play Caius. And then a Sphere of Annihilation attacks everybody, a la Disintegrate.
Yeah. Then we came upon the Star.
I think this one was Bahar who drew it.
The Star gave us a +2 to the ability score of our choice, up to a maximum of 24.
And this is actually just the stock Star card from 5th edition. I think it works fairly well. And the door opened and they stepped out. The party stepped out into a cliff at night overlooking an infinite ocean during a meteor shower. And just on the other side of the cliff was one more door with another card.
And that card was the Throne.
Kallik drew that one.
Kallik drew it. He learned that he had always had a keep.
Yes.
In the faithful starting town of Brazendale.
Yes, indeed. So if you ever use the town of Brazendale, it is run in absentia by Lord Kallik Delveros.
Yeah, and if you read the PDF that we put up way back when, like episode 2, maybe, like that, mm-hmm. And will someday be on the Dungeon Masters Guild as well.
Someday soon.
In the lore, one of the NPCs in that town is Lord Kallik Delveros, who has not been seen in a long time. And the rumor is that he won the title in a high-stakes card game. So, full circle on that one.
All of the rumors are true.
Yeah.
The next card was Fool. Kallik drew this one again, actually, because it's if a character had gained a level, then they lose a level. So he just lost the level that he gained.
Yeah. Yeah. For some reason, it was like, no, you've had too many good things. You're drawing again.
Right. I think he was like, I'm on a roll.
And then he drew
it's the allure of the deck. Right. Right. What I didn't want to have happen was someone, you know, everyone's level 19 and then you draw the Fool and you just lose a level and now you're at 18. Like, that just sucks.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you hadn't already gained a level, then if you're human, you would have aged 20 years. If you're half elf, you would have aged 40 years. I think those are the only people that we had in the party. And then Bastion, who is ageless, an ageless warforged, would have lost 2 to 4 points of wisdom.
Which would have been a pretty serious hindrance for him.
That's true. But it could be restored with Wish, and we had 2 players in the party who could cast Wish.
Wish, yeah.
And that opened into a Hall of Mirrors.
I like that. That's a clever manifestation of Fool.
The next card was the Vizier. Usually this lets you ask one single question the DM has to answer truthfully.
Right.
But so much exposition was happening here anyway that what I typically do is just have the Vizier flip all the other cards face forward so you know what you're drawing.
Right. So that's what happened.
Right. And the next card, of course, Ruin.
Right.
So then it became an argument about, well, I mean, I think you're due to draw Ruin. Right. Yeah.
Who has the most to lose? Least to lose.
So once it flipped, I think what happened was you guys were like, Ruin, hold on. Get naked.
Yeah.
Give us all your stuff and then draw that card.
Right. Right.
So whoever draws Ruin loses all their non-magical possessions. And the card says, including a keep or a title.
A title. And then that room had an anti-magic field.
Yeah.
Which would have been the ruin of our party, let's be honest.
The next card, the Idiot. I loved that there were a series of negative cards as soon as the Vizier flipped.
Yeah. So the Idiot, you lost 2 to 4 intelligence.
Or if you were wearing a headband of intellect, it was destroyed and you could never attune to one ever again. I know you didn't pick that, otherwise I never would have heard the end of it.
Well, hang on. So at this point, I wasn't using a headband of intellect.
Oh, that's
very
true.
Often.
It was only your simulacrum.
Yeah, I had a simulacrum who was wearing my headband of intellect to be me, but smarter. I had a vizier of my own who was just as charming of a devil as I was.
Again, the lost intellect could be restored with a wish, so eventually it did get repaired. Inside, there was just a regular fountain, and the party determined that it was a safe spot where they could take a rest, which is good.
Because we had piled up some exhaustion in the earlier.
Yes. And the only door out of there was flames. Typically, Flames earns the person who draws it the eternal enmity of some sort of denizen of the outer planes, of high-level demon.
Yeah, a demon or devil. Mm-hmm. And the DMG actually talks about how to use that as sort of this secret. That creature or entity should be kind of behind the scenes, messing with that player throughout.
Mm-hmm. And they won't necessarily know that's what's happening. You know, why do bad things keep happening to
right.
me?
Right, and then you come to find out, right?
Right. So if you ever do draw a card from the deck of many things and you don't know what it did, you're screwed.
Yeah, because it's either the rogue or flames.
Right. Remember, I was also using the deck as a method of exposition. So Skull, of course, there was a battle, but it wasn't really them, right? They learned more information. Flames ended up being the same way. It lets the party interact with a devil or a demon. So when they drew flames, the door opened into a well-appointed room with a roaring fireplace and comfortable chairs and Behemoth in a smoking jacket.
Right.
Saying, welcome, welcome to my home. I'm so glad we finally get to meet as equals.
And I just remember the conversation was like, wait a minute, you live here? It's like, where do you think I go inside my cup?
I'm so glad to be back in the book. The book and I have been separated for so long. Because if you recall, way back in Zendrick, the Drow Queen had the book. The chalice was with her minions in Stormreach.
Right.
And Behemoth, you learned, had been separated from the book by the Drow Queen and placed in the chalice.
Right.
But Behemoth belongs with the book. He is a book imp.
It all comes full circle.
Yes. Now, of course, all of you want to just kill him because you're like, you owe us a true name. What did we go through all of that for? Except for, I don't know, maybe Bastion, who right now has an intelligence of 6.
Right. Because we didn't bother wasting a wish.
That's right. I think Behemoth first said, oh, right, yeah, you do need his body back. It's in the closet.
Right.
Go get it. And he says, well, hold on, please, let's have a conversation, i.e. exposition, and explains that he knows what Belshalor is up to. In fact, he's infiltrated all of the most important aspects of the multiverse. He is working with Arandas Vol, who is the embodiment of the Dragon Marks of Eberron. And he is inside the Silver Flame, which is created by the Quaddles, the offspring of Sybaris. And of course, he is of Kyber. He is combining all these aspects of the progenitors, because what he really wants to do is create an entirely new world. He wants to destroy everything, all of the planes, and remake them in his own image. A place with no magic and no gods. Just Belshalor.
Sounds charming.
Behemoth, while not a good person, says, but I don't want to live there because also I will be destroyed.
Right. Yeah.
The book doesn't want to live there.
Because it's magic as well.
Yeah. So we've decided to help you out.
Right.
And then he speaks a name that makes the party's ears and nose and eyes bleed. And he says, this is Nistrim Shadar's true name, Enzul Eresh, the Subtle Herald. If you want, you can use it to summon him. I bet he knows Belshalor's true name.
And we'll find out what happens next. Next week.
So if that all sounds familiar to people who've been playing the game for a few decades, it's because I got the initial idea from Dungeon Magazine 19 from September-October 1989. There's a module in there called House of Cards by Randy Maxwell, which is just a really well-written module that basically involves using the deck of many things as the keys to a lock in a maze. It's really fascinating. I highly recommend taking a look at it. I changed a great deal of it. It's really just the initial idea, but again, it's really great work.
All right, so that's a great example for D&D. But what if you're not playing D&D? Is the deck of many things of any use in those kind of campaigns?
I mean, if you're going to adjust the effects of the cards, which honestly I think you should for a campaign, you can make a deck of some kind that has random effects that you can use in any kind of RPG. I could definitely see this in a White Wolf game.
Oh yeah, totally. Yeah. this would also be really good for like a strong artifact with crazy psychic phenomena, mm-hmm. in like a Warhammer 40K
yeah.
RPG. anything where magic isn't completely understood or could potentially go awry, I think this would work well.
Yeah, if you get your party into a situation where like they need the boons of the deck in order to accomplish something, and it's worth the potential drawbacks.
Yeah. It would also be an interesting kind of like virus in, well, I was initially thinking Shadowrun as a way like deckers are trying to, as they run into this thing, right? Like these random crazy effects start happening to them.
Mm.
But it actually probably works even better in Eclipse Phase, because then right. it can affect your physical form and not just your sort of Shadowrun deckingness.
Yeah. Crazy versions of the Titans and
right.
Yeah. Basilisk hacks.
Yeah. Yeah.
What about in Savage Worlds or in Deadlands with a Huckster?
I mean, that would be a really cool deck for the Huckster. Yeah.
Right. Like the final BBEG, like their deck is a deck of many things.
Yeah. Like he deals you a hand of poker,
right?
But you're actually playing the deck of many things. Like that would be incredible. So, okay. Let's try and pull one of these type of artifacts into our game. So what do we do? How do we build this, right?
Well, you could use a deck of cards that is associated with different kinds of fantastical effects, but that is maybe more appropriate for a setting outside of traditional D&D fantasy. So a normal tarot deck is, I think, more easily adaptable than the very recognizable deck of many things cards.
Well, it's also more easily attainable.
Yeah,
you can go buy a tarot deck for $5.
Right. Although I will say, I made a deck of many things on some sort of website that like prints them on demand.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of course, I also stole a bunch of art from DeviantArt. I'm right. not selling them. So.
Yeah. You like scoured DeviantArt for the...
Right.
It was a cool deck, though. It was a very cool deck.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, the Deadlands idea, you would want to use an actual deck of cards, mm-hmm. right? Like a poker deck, and just figure out a way to manipulate those cards.
Mm-hmm. And there's a very thorough Wikipedia entry for the deck of many things that tells you a lot about what the general effects are that you can then adapt from there.
Yeah, it tells you the theme of each card without getting into the mechanics.
Right.
So it's like you gain a level, right? It doesn't tell you like a certain number of XP, or like it doesn't tell you you gain an ability score increase. It's just like you become smarter, mm-hmm. right? So yeah, so I would use those two things as sort of your inspiration, and then try and tie the powers into the system that you're using.
Mm-hmm.
So figure out, right, based on that general description of the Wikipedia entry, how do I model that in this system, right? So an ability score increase, for example, in 5th edition might be like gaining a die in one of your stats in Savage Worlds.
Right. And this is an opportunity to use a bit of that system master you've got and offer things that are impossible or very difficult for a PC to get otherwise through normal leveling or something like that.
Oh, man. D20 and an ability score. Yeah. Or like a 6th dot in a World of Darkness game.
I don't know what that means, but I think it sounds awesome.
You're only allowed to have 5.
Yeah, the deck of many things by its nature breaks the rules. So go ahead and break the rules.
Right. It's probably going to end your campaign anyway.
Right. Push it to the end.
Right.
My players were level 19.
Yeah.
And most of these things are, it can be fixed with a wish. Well, they got 2 a day. Right. So.
Yep. And then I think doing the same thing that you did, which is tie the deck into your story so that you can tie the effects of the cards into the plot that you already have going, right? Like the skull card being tied to the Blood of Vol, the flames card being tied to the devil who had sent us in there, mm-hmm. right? Like those little touches really help bring it home instead of, oh, it's a random deck of cards on the table and it offers you a bargain.
Right. It'll make it harder for your players to walk away.
Right. Yeah. If that virus is actually a powerful artificial intelligence, you know, like maybe your decker doesn't just, you know, disconnect.
Right. Or maybe they can't.
Well, yeah. All right. Do you hear that, Ishan?
I am apparently locked in the donjon. Could you let me out?
I will let you out, but only because it's time to move on to the Character Creation Forge. So before Ooh. We do that, let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We do love hearing from you.
You can tweet at Shane at Mundangerous. That's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan at Evil Sans Carne. That's malice minus meat.
And you can tweet at the show at TPTcast.
You can also email us if you can't fit it into 140 characters at TotalPartyThrill@gmail.com.
And you can find us on the web at www.TotalPartyThrillCast.com.
We're also on Facebook and Instagram at TotalPartyThrill.
So this week in the Character Creation Forge, very fittingly, we have the gambler.
That's pretty self-explanatory. They tempt fate.
Yep. Even when you know the odds aren't in your favor, you always find a way to win.
It's like they're using or bending the luck to their own will.
Right. So in our case, in 5th edition, it's all about manipulating die rolls after you see them. So it's not about gaining advantage or disadvantage. It's about re-rolling dice, pre-rolling dice, or adding and subtracting dice to the roll.
Yeah, and there are actually quite a lot of things that do this in 5th edition. So for race, let's go halfling.
Yeah, because you get lucky, so right. You can re-roll once.
Always.
Yep. And then this build, this is a real piece of work here.
Yeah, I'd say so.
Bard 3, Fiend Warlock 9, Wild Magic Sorcerer 6, Divination Wizard 2.
You may notice that we're basically just going for all of the die manipulation abilities.
Right, and so we could start with the Fiend Warlock. The reason we have that in there is Dark One's Own Luck at level 6 is once per short rest you can add a d10 to an ability check or save. But the Warlock keys off of Eldritch Blast. Right? That's its main damage output. And being a level 9 Warlock, you have enough incantations to make your Eldritch Blast fully effective. And it's a cantrip, so it scales off your character level. So if all else fails, you can just shoot it with Eldritch Blast.
Yeah, which there are a lot of Warlock archetypes that just do that anyway.
Right. So at least you'll be combat effective. That's your baseline competency, right? It also gives you some cool stuff because you have 4 invocations. You use 2 of them to buff your Eldritch Blast, but you get things like Devil's Sight, which keeps the loser from blinding the room with like a smoke bomb kind of deal. You know, drop darkness and run away with the pot.
Or make sure that you can do that.
Right. Or Eldritch Sight, which would detect any magical cheating.
Mask of Many Faces gives you the face of someone who's got a great poker face as opposed to you.
Right. Or, you know, maybe someone who has a lousy poker face and you can cheat your tells.
And Thief of Five Fates, you can cast Bane on someone else, which is going to make them much worse at the game.
Right. Though that one is a little unsporting, if you ask me.
We made the cheater, not the gambler.
Yeah. So. Yeah. All right. So then you got Bard 3. That will be the lore bard. That gives you expertise. Now, you should take the gambler set, but I would say you could get by with just deception and insight, so you can read people at the table and, of course, lie to them.
Why are we not taking Rogue 1 just for expertise? Why all the way to Bard 3?
Well, Bard 3 gives you Cutting Words, which lets you use a bardic inspiration to reduce an attack roll, ability check, or damage.
The thing I love about this is, so you can be playing cards, and you literally make them worse at gambling by insulting them.
Right. Yeah, you just unnerve them at the table.
Yeah. I also like that at second level you can jack of all trades, which means you're good at everything, even if you don't have proficiency, which means you can pick up a game that you've never played before and hustle.
Right. And that's why I wouldn't take the gambler set, is because you're already getting half your proficiency bonus from jack of all trades. Mm-hmm. So you don't actually have to be good at the game. You're good at playing the man.
Wild Magic Sorcerer, of course, is in there because, well, we want a little actual gambling.
Yeah. You're literally gambling with your life sometimes.
You never know when the dice are going to come up fireball.
Right. Yeah, so Magic Surge is, of course, a constant risk because the DM gets to decide when you roll that. And some of those effects can be quite nasty.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, you get things like Tides of Chaos to give yourself advantage, and then Bend Luck to funnel those sorcery points into bonuses for you or penalties to other people.
Right. That will spend 2 sorcery points and add a D4 as a bonus or penalty to a roll.
And then we've talked about this before, but 2 levels of Divination Wizard gives you Portent, which is just amazing for pre-rolling 2d20s that you can use any time in the day for yourself or someone else.
you're in good shape. you know what cards are coming up in one hand, in two hands, actually.
Yeah, per day.
Per day, for sure.
Maybe in the morning you actually used, not a tarot deck, but your actual deck of playing cards and laid them out and told your own fortune.
Right, or you just had that card up your sleeve.
Yeah. Of course, for feats, lucky.
Yeah, you know, if all else fails, just reroll. So, mediocre combat effectiveness, but is going to be very, very difficult to affect, right? And always going to be making sure that when it counts, the effect gets through.
Yeah, and I think actually a really great support character.
Yeah, I mean, definitely like a party buff type character.
Except when they kill everybody with a fireball.
Yeah, I might play this character. Actually works in Dark Sun. I might play this character in Dark Sun.
Oh my god, and then you can defile too.
I don't want to do that.
We'll have to kill you.
Right.
Immediately.
Right.
If we can.
Yeah, good luck. You know I'm passing that save. All right, Ishin, what's your character's backstory?
It's basically Matt Coffin from The Wheel of Time. Right, he hears dice in his head. Things shift around him to make things go his way. He has the luck of the dice. Now, this works in, you know, traditional fantasy as someone who has grown up and has just always been lucky. Right, they're a halfling. They're happy-go-lucky. They tend to be a lucky kind of race to begin with. But things just go better for them than normal. And I wouldn't play any of these mechanical abilities as conscious. They would all be things that just happen that they don't even expect, or, you know, they're really worried, but then, you know, at the last second, the arrow misses them, yeah, strangely.
It's like touched by fate.
Yeah, exactly. And then I would say later on in their arc, she realizes that she is, in fact, an avatar of, you know, in the Forgotten Realms, Timora, Lady Luck. You know, she is chosen by whatever deity controls luck or the fates in this setting.
I like that. Some of the abilities require a reaction, which would just be panic.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. But it works.
All right, what about your gambler?
So my gambler began as a very mediocre bard.
I love that.
Yeah, not trained in performance because I don't have room to waste on those skill slots.
Great at reading people,
right.
Not so good at singing.
Exactly. Found out he was better at gambling and making money off of the patrons than he was playing for their charity. He eventually gets into a high-stakes game and bets much more than he's worth. To make it out of town alive, he has to make an unholy bargain. And that's how we get fiend-backed. So he makes a bet with the devil, Fel Hellemuth. That's Phil Hellmuth, the World Poker Tour player.
I'm going to trust you on that one.
Don't act like I didn't Google professional poker players and find the one who sounded the most like a demon. In exchange for tapping some of Fel Hellemuth's power, as a mortal, upon his death, he must play a single hand for his immortal soul. Of course, Fel Hellemuth has been so kind as to provide an imp to aid in his travels and, you know, keep an eye out for the gambler's untimely demise.
You know, as a GM, I would look at this backstory and be like, this is really a front story because you want this to happen later in your career.
Yeah.
That's annoying. But then I would say, but it's good.
Yeah, start at level 4. Just go ahead and start this character at level 4. So you're a level 3 bard and a level 1 warlock and just move on.
Really, in 5e, try to start at level 4.
Yeah, I mean, it's how my character got to level 20, all right? All right, if you want to support the show, the easiest way to do that is to leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. If you're willing to help us out, we'll read your 5-star review on the air.
You can also find us on Stitcher. It's like a Pandora for podcasts. If you like or favorite us there, the algorithm will help other people find us.
And you can also find us on Google Play. So what do we have planned for next week's episode?
We're continuing our series on playable races, and we're talking about half-orcs.
And in the Character Creation Forge,
we're building a drunken master.
Well, that's it for episode 61 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we've lived up to our name. But either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishin. Thanks for listening.